One, two, three. I'm interviewing my good friend, longtime friend, John Hill, trainer over here at Churchill Downs Training Center. And this is April 18, 1995. Good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
I'm here this morning to interview you regarding your participation in the horse industry. And you and I have been friends for a long time. And I really value your judgment and hope that we can have an interview where some candid comments can come out about the participation of African Americans in the horse industry in 1995. Would you first start by telling us your name and your birthplace and a little bit about your family?
Well, I'm John Hill. I'm 57 years old now. I was born and raised here in Louisville, Kentucky. I came around with a good friend, and you probably know him, was Arthur Perosia, which they called Tat Perosia, years ago, probably 35 to 40 years ago. And that's how I really got started myself. And I think today that Tat was one of my favorites. He taught me a lot. He taught a lot of the young guys that's around, and you probably know them, but I can go on and on and on because I admire Tat because I thought he was awful sharp, and I used to talk about being a trainer, and he used to tell me all the time, it ain't the idea of training the horse, conditioning. He said, I'm a conditioner, you know. So I said, well, maybe one day I can learn this, you know, and I never had no idea that this would stick with me.
All right. Were you born in Louisville?
Born in Louisville, Kentucky.
You went to school here?
Louisville Catholic High.
Graduated from Louisville Catholic High?
In 1956.
Yeah. Of course, Tats and I are friends. I was to see him Sunday. I was down. He's 102.
Yes.
Going to be 103 years old. He's just lying up there. Yeah. His wife, Madeline, is taking care of him. And all of us admire him.
Yeah.
It's because of Tat that you really got interested in horse racing.
Every broken bone in my body is because of Tat.
All right. You went to Central High School? Catholic High School.
Yeah.
Back in those days, it was a segregated Catholic high school.
Colored High. That's what they named it. So they wanted you to know that it was colored only, you know. So
were any of your relatives involved in horse racing?
No, not really. My dad, he liked horses, but to participate in them, back in the days when he was coming up, he used to tell me, well, there was a chosen few, you know, and the ones that were chosen to work for the good farms and things, and all that. Only thing he really closest he's got to be working is hauling hay and straw for him.
So none of your relatives, grandfathers or anything like that, you just sort of got into it because of an interest that was sparked by your relationship with Tats Perosia.
Right.
And when was that about?
I had to be 12 years old.
12 years old?
Yeah.
You've been in the horse industry now about 45 years, right?
Easy.
Yeah.
Easy, 45.
And you were living in Beecher Terrace?
Beecher Terrace, 11th Street.
And then Tats was living in the same area.
Yeah.
Because of your friendship with him that you got involved. And how did you get involved first? By coming out to the track walking?
Well,
hot walking?
Yeah. Well, you know, Tat looked at us one morning and he said, well, don't y'all guys have nothing to do? So we just went on and looked at him because we thought he was a little short guy and he had that little funny lingo. And me and Kendrick Moore, and we said, well, don't have too much to do. He said, y'all want a job working for me at the racetrack with horses? And we just took it for granted. He's just conversation, you know. But the next day, this guy was knocking on the door around about 5 o'clock in the morning. And he told our parents, well, I talked to these guys, and do they want to go, man? I put my clothes on fast, I was ready. And so Tap took us on out there, and when we got involved at Churchill Downs on Longfield, it was more like just getting familiarized with it. Water, changing water, emptying water, and when Tap found out that we was interested, we went from that to walking horses, then doing the stalls, and We was hooked.
You were hooked from that point on.
Right on.
When did you officially get involved on the track, just working there? Have you always worked full-time on the track, or did you...
No. What it was, back in those days, you know, when I was a young man, when I got out of high school, I went to the Army for 2 years in 59 to 61, and then when I got back out of the service, I ran back into TAP, and I need some help. I said, okay, so I got involved again. I came back out there, and the more I was around the horses, and just the more I felt at home. And Pat told me one day, said, why don't you go ahead and get your trainer license? I said, well, I don't think I'm sharp enough. I said, I don't think I know enough. He said, well, you stick with me. So I stayed with Tad about a year. Then I left Tad. I went to another white fella named Bob Gross in Lexington. Then I went with Hal Steele. Then I went with Oscar Dishman. Then I went with James Jackson's father. I went with a guy called Willie Bell and all these guys. This was work that I was doing for no pay.
That right.
But learning.
But were you, at that time, were you a young adult? Were you married?
Oh, yeah.
Did
yeah,
you married
I was married.
About that time?
Yeah.
Did you have another job?
Yeah, working for B.F. Goodrich.
B.F. Goodrich.
Yeah.
So you worked for B.F. Goodrich in the evenings or afternoons?
In the swing shift.
Swing shift. And then whenever you got the time, and you would come to the racetrack. So
no, I was at the racetrack every day.
Oh, it was all the time?
All the time. That job was just...
Did you travel with the horses?
Right. Went everywhere.
Whenever they went, you went, right?
Especially when I was on vacation, as they was in New York, Chicago, that's where I went.
Yeah, so you, that goes way back then, right? Long
way
time
back,
ago
yeah.
then. So then, after you had this relationship with the horses, sort of like working and going to the track, then when did you first get involved as a trainer?
Back in 1974. Yeah. So I just decided, I said, this is it. This is what I'm going to do.
And so then, since 1974, you've been in training full time.
Right.
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 How many horses do you have present?
Five.
Five horses. And you've had a public stable there?
Right.
And how does that work?
Well,
you train for various owners, or you go solicit owners, or they solicit you?
Yeah,
what goes on?
To be truthful about it, it's, here in Kentucky, it's hard for a black man to get horses now. You got to be awful lucky, because I don't know if it's the industrial. I don't know if it's the people that have the money for the haves and have not, but I've been lucky. I have a fellow named, attorney named Fred Radulovich.
I know
and
him.
Fred been with me a good 10 years. And I haven't really went out to try to get no one else, because it's more of a partnership.
I see.
Because the people around here in Kentucky, it's just hard for a black man. And they want you to take care of their horses, but they don't want you to have that authority, that title of trainer, you know. They like to give him to the big shot. And once you get a horse and get the going good, he's gone. Need to give him to somebody else. Say, well,
so,
it's been nice.
What you were saying corroborates some of the opinions that I've gotten from others, and that is the demise of blacks in the horse industry. And you've been around long enough to see what it looked like years ago in terms of blacks working on the backside, and that's what we're particularly interested
yeah.
in. How do you see that? Why?
Big change. I think that my own opinion, back when I was a kid, a teenager, when all your trainers, maybe a very few the trainers were listed as celebrities. They come around because they were overseers. And the black guys, I don't know if they had trainer license or not, but they could easily get him because he worked for the white man. Okay. So, on the behalf of this guy having a bunch of horses and having another black guy running his stables. So you never didn't meet this particular individual until race day. You know, so
but the white name was on it.
That was right. That's
right. The blacks were really doing the trade.
Helping hands. But the white man wasn't there. Period. Okay. Grooms, hot walkers. When I was a teenager, you didn't see none. Period. I mean, you very seldom seen a white person. Period. Unless it was race day, they might come around. And I think what really turned it around was the money situation.
All right.
And once when the money got good, then the blacks start fading to the farms, to other areas, because it was getting tougher and tougher in Kentucky, like it is now. I would have to say that with a black trainer in the state of Kentucky, it's just like going back to slavery days.
Huh.
That's the way they treat it. That's why most of you black trainers leave here if they got anything on the ball. I've been lucky. I had good people at Churchill. I could say Butch Laird, Mike, stall superintendent, Bobby,
Hargle.
And Jerry, yeah, Hargle, yeah, and Bobby, Jerry Bott. They've been, I can't really say nothing about these guys because they're very good to me, you know. So whatever they reflect for somebody else, I don't know. But I take my hat off to them because they have really, to be truthful, they have really gave me a shot in this, you know, in the industry. That's the only reason I stay home.
But in general, you don't find a lot of black trainers around now.
No way.
Right? Nor do you find a lot of black grooms or hot walkers or exercise boys.
No.
How many black exercise boys are there around? Do you use black exercise boys on your horses when you can find them? Or can you find them?
And then when you do find them, they work for a white man because of the money situation and thing. And I don't have those means and things to really pay one. I can take a freelance guy, you know,
right,
and do it. But then they just too hard to get. I have Spanish kids to get on my horses, you know. But the black guys, it's just so few.
Yeah.
So few.
And that's the way it is in the industry right now. Do you think there's any way that can be revived? That, like Tet came to you when you were a youngster, pre-teen,
yeah,
12 years old, brought you in. Now the youngsters nowadays don't seem to gravitate toward the racetrack. Not even the ones that live in my neighborhood, close to the racetrack.
Right. Well, you know, I think the blacks on a racetrack now is just like instant coffee, instant cream. They want it all right now, to be taught, to come around, take the aches and pains. They don't want that.
So they want it
everything
now.
they want it now. I mean, that's the way they taught.
And I've heard that one before,
yeah,
too.
You know,
I think that is correct.
Yeah,
in other words, they want instant gratification, right?
Right.
They want it right now. They can't delay gratification enough to wait until something good happens down the line. And this industry is one where you have to be patient.
Right.
Over the years, how many good horses have you had? Have you ever had good stake horses?
Yeah. Stake horses, I had one. And I have, which I ran him in the Derby trial. And
who
he ran
it?
Fifth. It was a horse called Ryan's Rodeo. One of the best coats you ever want to see to keep his testicles. 90% of them I cut
right now
and bring them around to be good boys, you know. But then just...
Why do you cut them?
Well, it's disposition.
Right.
Some that... you just ain't gonna be able to handle. Some just like a wild kid.
Right.
Some just like you hear that thing, old saying about jumping the fence and spreading his oats. Some of them just want to spread too many oats.
Right.
And then this is a business. It ain't no time for spreading oats.
Right.
You got to get down. You got to get knowledgeable of what you're doing. And they don't want to do that.
But the horse that you ran at Derby trial, you were able to keep him as a colt?
Yeah, I kept him as a colt. But I later on, he caught pneumonia on me, and he died. But I have had
You, up to the Derby trial, had he won?
Oh yeah, he had done pretty good, and I went on to mostly horses. I guess from then on up, claiming horses in a place from 8,000 to 12,000. And then me and Fred, one of the owners, I said one day, I said, well, I'm retiring now and I'm going to get into the business, and I think what we should do is go ahead and bet our stock. So we went into the breeding thing, where we're breeding our own.
Are you in breeding now?
Yeah, me and Trevor Dolovich.
You got a farm?
Got a farm in Crestwood. He does. So,
Who's the stallion?
We go to Lexington. We figure that, you can raise your mares, but you don't have to raise no stallions because it's too many good ones.
Right. So what you do is get the mares, bring them to your farm, mm-hmm. and you take the mares to stallions in Lexington.
Claiborne Farm.
You stand for certain fees.
Yeah.
You breed the mares to those standing stallions in Lexington and bring them back in here, and they foal, and then you raise them. You raise them from the foal stage?
Yeah, from day one. And that's like now, even down when we go to Kingland to the sales, we go every year. And I buy horses at the sales. So we have brought Jabba Goals, Risen Stars, Metfield. These are all nice horses. And like Metfield, he's a son of Seattle Slough.
Right.
And I got a couple of them right now.
Jaffa Gold.
Yeah, the Jaffa Gold.
What was the one? Jaffa Rideau?
Jaffa Rideau.
Yeah. He got claimed from you.
Yeah.
Right.
They claimed us from 20,000, but otherwise we would have kept him, but it was time to go.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So, you know, you got to recognize that when a horse is developing a problem, and if his heart is good enough, and you just like going fishing, if you can't go catching catfish with dough balls, you got to have worms and things, you know. So we went fishing and somebody bit, and that was good.
Right.
And plus they claimed the horse, we won the race, so it done pretty good.
So you got the money for the claim and the money for the purse, right?
Hank Aaron special.
And that's all right then. You just go on and get you another one and then train him
move on.
That's right. Who are the horses that you have right now? How many do you have right now?
I have five in training right now. I got two babies. I got a Risen Star right there, and I got a Metfield. Then I got a...
Are they two-year-old now?
Yeah, they're two-year-old now.
Have they been broken?
Broken.
Who breaks your horses?
Normally I break them myself.
That right?
Yeah. This year.
You get up on them and break them?
No, I'm too big for that.
You break them in the stall.
I have my own exercise board, but we do it the way I want it done. You know.
And you bring them up the way you want them brought up. You got a particular way that you would like to raise them, right?
Yeah.
And generally, when you raise them your way, they do pretty well, right?
Knock on wood, so
you've got pretty good prospects for this Risen Star. What is that? Double Joe F.
Double Joe F. I think that was a French mare, and that Double Joe F was out of another good stallion called Exclusive Native.
Oh yeah.
So that horse has got the breeding. Oh, yeah. Plus he's
Exclusive Native. That's a firm.
Yeah, band. All in that right.
Right.
And that horse right there, it might not mean nothing, but it's always good to have the paperwork.
Is that
the breeder's cup.
26, is that a filly?
That was a hip number at the sale at Kingland.
Is that she a filly?
Mm-hmm. She's a filly. Mm-hmm. That's what that F is for over there.
Right. All right. Well, then, right now, I know you could go back and look at some people you've had relationships with on the racetrack. Who would you regard as, besides Cass, as some of the people who have been instrumental in helping you achieve what you've achieved on the racetrack?
Well, Hal Steele was a good influence. He had Bob to like. And we would rubbing him when he came along, and I think he got beat by Proud Clarin back in the, what year, I forget, but then Hal Steele, a fellow intellectual, we call him Grossy Baby, but it was Bob Gross, big influence. Warner Jones, I used to work for Warner. Warner used to tell me all the time, you'll be all right, just keep striking. He said, hell, didn't nobody give me nothing, you know. But I think he was just exaggerating. I think everybody got everything.
That's the ex-president of the
Church of Bound, yeah.
The late Warner Jones.
Warner, I worked for him for on and off for years as a kid, you know. So,
who were some of the blacks that you've seen around the racetrack who were expert at what they were doing? Take black trainers.
Sherman White was good with a horse. Sherman. Even down another guy my age, I have to admire him because he's a hell of a horseman too, and that's James Jackson. He left Lexington.
He's the one that's up in Detroit.
He's in Detroit now, right. And James is good. I mean, some people say, well, James this, James that, but I've seen James in action. James is a good trainer. Oscar Dishman is a good trainer. These are guys are knowledgeable that approach their horse not with a gun,
right.
but with a shank and a bridle and taught a horse. You know, a lot of people just don't, they don't have the patience, the time. And if you don't, you're in the wrong game.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
oh, yeah.
Those three, and I have to say, I didn't know him as good, but Clifford Scott.
Oh, yeah.
I was around
Clifford. From Chicago.
Yeah, and he's Louisiana and Chicago.
Right.
Clifford's good.
As you look at it now, how do you see the plight of blacks in horse racing? I notice that a lot of the entertainers and a lot of the sports people have put big bucks into horse racing, like Hammer and Gordy and some of those. We were talking about the participation of blacks presently in horse racing. I was asking a question about the involvement of the entertainers and the athletes who have big monies, and the ones that have come in recently, I noticed Hammer was in 3 or 4 years ago, and I noticed Barry Gordy. Do you see that as a wave of the future? And if so, would you just talk about it a little bit?
I sit back and I think about it all the time, and sometimes I say, you know, I like to get in touch with some black entertainer. Doctor, a lawyer, a businessman, but is this something that if these guys are big shots, big timers, it seems like they kind of lean towards the white man. Why, I couldn't tell you. Look at Hammer and Lucas.
Right.
Now, and it's a funny thing about some of these guys. When you're more knowledgeable, I think I'm just as good as any of them.
I know you are.
Yeah. But if I made a approach to these guys, and I said, well, you know, I like to train the horse for you. So, next thing I know, they say, well, can you write a resume or something like that? I said, why the hell should I, excuse my language, why should I write your resume? Lucas didn't write you none. Woody Stevenson didn't write you none. And I think I'm more knowledgeable of a horse than they are. Why should I do this? I mean, this is Hammer's brother. He approached my son. And I said, nah, you don't need me. And then they want to cut your throat a little. Where they pay these guys $75, $80 per day per horse. They want to give you $35 and $40.
I see. So it's back to a mentality then. That's a mentality.
Bottom line.
That we brought out of slavery.
Yeah. That a
white's ice is colder than our ice.
There you go. That's right. That's the bottom line.
And they just feel that, and they feel, it's back to going to a white lawyer over a black lawyer.
Yeah.
A white doctor over a black doctor, because they just feel that they have it and we don't. So it's something that we have to work on, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we shouldn't have to. Because if you're knowledgeable of this game, we the one
that'll
who inherit.
That's right.
We the one who taught them.
That's right.
So what you trying to tell me, we don't taught somebody else better than what we are. The teachers had come to pupils, you know.
That's right.
It don't make no sense.
Yeah.
And I'm the type now, I'm 57 years old, and maybe I'm a little headstrong, but I get mad. I get angry because of I know what to do for Hart. Man, if I can't, I would get somebody like Hart Hill, Rick Fisher, because these are
the best veterans.
They're veterans.
Mm-hmm.
They're good.
Yeah.
And when they say they were, John, I don't know,
yeah,
then they don't know.
That's right.
So, but I try to take my knowledge as far as I can go, to the limit. But then,
we were talking about the participation of blacks in horse racing right now. And as we wind down here, I just would like for you just to give me some of your feelings about the horse industry and what some of your goals and objectives are. What do you hope to do in the future in this business?
Well, you know, my goals is, I guess, just like every red-blooded American, black and white, is all these other races, $1 million and the $3 million and $10 million, it's only one race you want underneath your hat.
That's the Kentucky Derby.
They said, man, you're talking about a dream come true, you know. So that, and I wish
you, you'd like to get somebody to run in the Kentucky Derby, right?
Run in it and
win it.
Win it. If I ever have a good horse, and if I thought he was just a good horse, I wouldn't run him in Kentucky Derby. But if I know he can win that Kentucky Derby, I would run him.
Right,
because I wouldn't embarrass him.
That's the race of races.
That's the daddy of all of them. You know, he.
What makes the Kentucky Derby such a goal,
well,
as you see it? We're coming up to the Kentucky Derby soon.
Yeah, well, you know, I just go back, and even as a kid, man, the old Kentucky home and watching those horses come out, I guess it's like Michael Jordan, anybody else is hitting the game at with 1 second left on the clock, you know.
Right.
It's something to make you just your blood boil, you know. It's just like being baptized and becoming a Christian, you know. It's just something, a feeling that you get that you just don't get it unless you love what you're doing, you know. And I wish that people would be more gratifying about one another on the racetrack. The drug thing, they could knock that out. It's just so many good things about the racetrack I remember as a kid, but now that you got so many influence that's bad, you know, I wish I could change a lot of that, which I know I can't, but...
You would try, though.
Yeah, I would.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Because that's what's happened to a whole lot of our... You think that a lot of our good... I noticed in my neighborhood, a whole lot of guys who grew up around with me in their late 50s and 60s now, on the racetrack 35, 40, 50 years, some of them, now they're just lying around. Some of them are drunks and alcoholics and whatever.
Yeah,
become disenchanted. And that, I think, has a lot to do with their condition as it is.
Yeah, I really do.
And I don't know what you can do about that, but it seems like some of the young men that I knew growing up have sort of vanished, and we don't see replacements for them coming along. So what we're seeing now is an increase in the numbers of Hispanics and women on the racetrack.
Taking over.
They're taking over.
Yeah, taking over.
And this is a legitimate industry, isn't it?
It's great.
You could make money in
this industry. It's great. It's just like getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and coming out here and watching your animal train.
Hey, excuse me, how you doing?
Is this a case in point, right? The young man knows that about
right
everything,
there.
Doesn't he?
Right there.
But he's unreliable, right?
His dad had great knowledge. And he has too.
Yeah,
I call his name, but he can do anything in the world with a horse.
Yeah,
but won't use his knowledge, and that's what
that sort of befuddling, isn't it, John?
Yeah,
you've got all these guys with all this knowledge, but they won't
and
use it.
And don't use it. Yes, sir. Don't use it. You know, it's...
Well, thank you very much for your interview, and good luck on your horses. I hope that you have great success this spring.
And see you in the winter.
Always good to see you, John.
Thank you, Joe.